So now, I do think that we are probably pretty much underway. Let me go ahead and get my mouse hooked up on a computer. I can't use this finger thing. It seems to be more of a problem, so I like to use a mouse. I think the first thing we should do is go ahead and sign this paperwork that I sent you a copy of earlier, but here's the hard copy. I can leave one copy with you, but if you want to sign.
What does it say?
This is the part about the granting Chemical Heritage Foundation, ASMS, the fact that we are recording this history on the 22nd and 23rd of May.
So this is my obligation to this.
And so it explains all the details.
You'd have to give me about 5 minutes.
That's fine, no problem. I can continue to get things arranged here.
I should die.
Well, I have to
not very excited about.
You don't like that part.
Incapacitated. There is one problem with this.
Uh-huh.
Is that in the summer. Roughly July 15th to August 15th,
mm-hmm.
we have a cottage on an island.
Oh boy.
On the Pacific side of, so it's north of Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. That must be beautiful.
Yes, it's really a beautiful place. And because it's a small island, it's a rather quiet. Now, the mail, we can we could ask that I would have to check with Beverly, but I'm pretty sure that we can ask that the mail is transferred from Edmonton to a post thing,
mm-hmm.
that is, the island's too small, doesn't have that, but just across, so that period, as I said, is roughly July 15th, August 15th,
mm-hmm.
and where we might delay the manuscript.
Well, that's not a problem because it's there's a queue of oral history recordings that need to be transcribed, and this recording may not even be transcribed by then, you know, because there's so many others in a queue.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I wouldn't be concerned about the fact that you won't be accessible for maybe, say, about a month during the year, that's not really a problem.
Yeah, yeah. You mean it will be delayed?
Yeah.
By that much and be no problem.
I would anticipate it would be at least a year before the transcript is, or the audio recording is transcribed,
right,
because of all of the
that's
others
fine.
That are
yeah,
there. So it should
fine.
Not be a problem.
I see. Yeah.
So if you're okay with that preliminary agreement, if you go ahead and sign at the, I think on the, let's see down here on the, if you sign here and I'll sign there, and then we can.
Let me just. Yeah, so let me just. So basically, you'll be sending me a copy of
right.
what has happened
right.
here.
Whatever you say yeah. here, you yeah. get a chance to look at it.
And then I have to approve this.
Right. You get approval before anything. So the only people that are able to see what's happening here are you and I and the transcription. Mm-hmm. The person who does the transcription,
yeah.
and they're obliged not
yeah.
to say anything to anybody.
Yeah, I'm not concerned about the privacy of it because
okay.
there's nothing.
Well, you may say something that about a colleague that you may want not to, that can happen in the process.
Yeah.
We're having a conversation. Think yeah. of this more as a conversation
yeah.
than as a something more mm-hmm. formal than that.
And will you make a copy?
Well,
of
I've got another copy for you.
Oh.
So,
oh, I see. Yeah. So
sign.
I'll sign here and
okay.
you give me this copy.
Right.
Yeah. And here, what did it say? Date.
Yeah, this is the 22nd, I believe.
What is it?
22nd of May, yes.
Yeah, 2013.
And that's good. So you have this copy to keep for your file,
yeah.
and I'll go ahead and sign this, and then you've got all this formality taken care of. So that is good. And like I say, it will be a while before you see the transcript.
Mm-hmm.
So don't be too concerned about the timing,
mm-hmm.
but we'll be assured that it's being worked on.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd like to do is I'll guide the interview primarily by asking you questions. We want to explore some things. So if you you don't need to be concerned too much with this. That was just for you to get some ideas about what we talked about. But I'll kind of do the questioning, and then we'll just like I say, you don't have to be too concerned about that list of things. That was just to kind of
yeah. Well, I.
So first off, we begin these interviews by stating that my name is Michael Grayson. I'm in the office of Paul Cabarly at the University of Alberta on the 22nd of May in 2013. And Paul is the subject of an interview about his career in science and in general in mass spectrometry in more particular. So having gotten that formal piece of information available so that sometime when someone picks this up and listens to it, they'll know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Rather than listen to it and wonder what's going on here. Yeah. So I usually like to ask people about their family. Mm-hmm. And my understanding from what little I know about your early history is you were born in Bulgaria.
Yeah.
And your parents were professionals or?
Yeah, so I was born in Bulgaria in 1926.
26.
My parents, basically at that time, the mother just stayed at home.
Okay.
Looking after the children.
Okay.
So, but my father was actually, he was born in Bulgaria, but he was half Czech and half German.
That's interesting. But he was born in Bulgaria.
He was born in Bulgaria. Bulgaria was liberated from a Turkish domination which lasted 500 years.
Uh-huh.
And then Russia, which at that time still Tsarist Russia,
mm-hmm.
Russia had a conflict with Turkey, and at that time the Turks had occupied Bulgaria, as I said, for 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then since the Russians in part because they were against the Turk and in part maybe wanting to liberate Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm.
And now Bulgaria is totally without any people trained for various things, mm-hmm. that are apart from agriculture,
mm-hmm.
from having, and so a Czech, some Czechs, this is the father of my father,
mm-hmm.
decide to come to Bulgaria, and because they have some experience, start a business,
okay.
that will be of their to their profit and profit of Bulgaria,
mm-hmm.
and there come down the Danube with a ship at that time they had already, and come to Sofia, which is the biggest city, and they start first with a factory for matches.
To light fires.
They make a small factory. I mean, that's not nowadays factory, but they to make matches. And because they saw there are no matches.
Uh-huh.
And however, the Bulgarians were not accustomed to matches. They used flint.
Oh my.
Flintstone. They were accustomed to that. So the factory didn't do well. And they had to close it. And let me think now. So that that's the father of my father. And so my father, they're basically having very little money.
Mm-hmm.
The father also catches pneumonia and dies.
Mm-hmm.
So he's left with his mother. And he starts, he has to start very early, at an age of about 7 or so, to work. And he was lucky. There was, Bulgaria had a king at that time who had a park. I mean,
the game preserve? Or?
Yes, it's a sort of a garden in which they had also the you know, the, a house or whatever one could call it.
An estate.
And they were doing, they import some German gardeners to make a park with all flowers, etc. And my father was hired, or managed to get hired, and he was of a very, very young. And he actually liked the work. It was all outside a lot. And he had a friend who was very kind to him. And in the evening, he would teach my father what they learned in school.
By the way, can I get your parents' names while we're, I'm thinking
his
about
his name it? Is Paul.
Paul?
Paul also, so I'm after him.
And your mother's name?
Catherine.
Is that a K, I guess?
Yeah, K.
Very good. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but she was Bulgarian.
And your friend was teaching your father, or your father's friend.
Yeah, so he helped him to be literate. He did not get anything, but at least he could write, and so he was literate. And gradually, he actually made his way up. And, you know, all details a bit too long, but at the end, he becomes very prosperous and a major shareholder of a company called Trans-Balkania. The Balkan, that comes from the Balkans.
Right.
Bulgaria is in the Balkans.
Right.
And basically, they would, people when they export, say something from Bulgaria to, say, Germany, it goes on trains, but somebody has to follow that this stuff ends up where it's supposed to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And these are then agencies that take care as this thing is moved from one place to the other. So there's another company, say in Switzerland has a company of that type, which is called Danzig. And so in essence, he managed to become the director and major shareholder.
Wow.
And actually, I had a very nice childhood, and we were very well off. We had a beautiful house.
In what town or city was this? Where you
in
live?
Sofia, in the capital. And houses there are built, so they last for centuries.
Uh-huh.
It's ferro concrete. That was then of some use later because the Sofia got bombed.
Mm-hmm.
So we could hide in the basement, which would provide us with some. Yeah, so in essence, I went to school, and that was to a German school, which teaches also Bulgarian, so both is...
So you were learning German and Bulgarian?
And Bulgarian. That it's required by Bulgarian government that you get Bulgarian.
Oh, sure.
But the German was a kind of additional thing because most of the trade of Bulgaria went to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, German was the most important foreign language. And we were exporting sort of fruit and vegetables and so on, and getting machinery
mm-hmm.
from the Germans.
So you were born in 1926, right?
Yes, in Sofia.
So this was a time of pretty much turmoil. I mean, your youth up until when you left Bulgaria, the Balkans were kind of...
Well, the turmoil that occurred was that now, you know, there was Hitler, and Hitler starts a war, and he thinks he's going to beat the Russians like nothing. He said, I just kick the door in and the whole house will fall down. But he was bitterly wrong because the Russians had tanks that were twice as large as the German tanks.
Oh, really?
And he didn't know that. He was so conceited. And the first year they made great progress into, they came to Moscow but didn't manage to occupy Moscow. But then during he was so conceited, he thought they'll beat them in a month, so these German soldiers had cotton uniforms, and the winter comes and they start dying by just cold.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, the second year, and to make the story short, that was then in Stalingrad, and the Germans get surrounded and beaten at a tremendous loss of human things, because it was too cold. So then they come, now it's the Russians that are expanding into Europe, and they come through Bulgaria.
So Bulgaria is located north of Turkey.
Yes, just north of Turkey, but in Europe, like Turkey
right.
is in Asia
like
Minor.
Between Russia and Germany or Czechoslovakia at the time. I can't remember my geography that area,
yeah.
But basically the Russians were going to come through Bulgaria.
They came to Bulgaria, and we were pretty scared initially that they would... I had a sister that was 18 years old, and we were scared that these Russians would rape every... You know, they had bad reputation. And but they proved to be, on the whole, very much better than we were afraid of. And, yeah, they are sort of passing through, but at night they have to sleep somewhere, and they come and knock at the door of the house, and you have to open, and they walk in and look at this thing, and they say, six. And six Russians will be sleeping there.
Mm.
And so the dining room and the living room, these guys go and they had these things. My sister, we hid at the top floor, but actually they were quite okay. And
this was about what year, 1940, 30, 41?
Yes. Something like this, you know, the war started 39,
mm-hmm.
so it would be, let's add five, so... Something like this, I would say 34.
But up until this time, until the war started, it, you had about 10 or 12 years where you had a fairly pleasant life, your family and you. And
yes, as when I was young, yeah.
Say up but until about 37, yeah, 38?
And on the whole, pretty soon, well, just a second. I did not get to remember.
You were.
So that was after the war is over, and then of course we. By that time, I was close to. Finishing high school, and then because my father had this business, I wanted to work in that business, and I then went to, it was a sort of a deals with commerce, yeah, but that was just one year.
So this is a school, like a business school would be.
Yes, it's a business school. You learn about all kinds of things. How useful they were, I don't know, but in any case, then now it was still, this was sort of a communist, you know, they don't let you leave the country too easily. But I have a defect. My spine is curved. It's called scoliosis. But at that time, very little. But I thought, gee, they, you know, they want to have only very strong people. I was actually in very good shape, but and actually, at that time, to get an X-ray, they didn't have the plaques. It's too expensive, but they do it on the. You know, what is this thing on a screen that it's just like the TV, but and the guy quickly drew sort of my spine, and he shows.
So they didn't have a film recording of it.
No, it's just on the scope.
And then he could draw
by hand. I don't think this man could have lasted too long because he's constantly exposed to radiation.
He's on the wrong side of the X-ray machine.
Yeah. So anyway, but it was, you know, it wasn't very, very noticeable. But no. So, and then I got the idea. Well, I found out that in Prague, in the Czech thing, there was a doctor that was great specialist, and will fix that. But I also thought, well, I'm already getting out of Bulgaria, because the Czechs were not yet the real, like we had communism 100%. The Czech was 30%, sort of.
They were like more of a political party in Czechoslovakia, whereas in Bulgaria.
Much more at that time. Later they also got the revolution there. But at that time they were not yet commies. And I got there, and the guy said, there's nothing I can do for you. But I said, I thought, well, that's, I'm going to get out of here. And the Czechs weren't interested what happens to the Bulgarians, so I went to the Swiss embassy there, and I said that I'd like to go to Switzerland to study. And my father had some money in Switzerland, and so I thought that won't work, but they gave me, you know, the Swiss are very sticky about, but they gave me the thing, and I go to Switzerland.
Now, did you do this with your father's blessing, or?
Did
your father know that you wanted to leave
yes.
the family and go
yes.
abroad, and he was okay
yes.
with that?
Even though it exposed him to some danger, but you see, it's not such a highly organized thing that they would know exactly what's happening to me. I've gone to the Czech thing, and in fact, when I got a Swiss visa, I immediately went there was no way there, just by plane. And on the plane, there was another Czech guy that we were in the same seats. And he was a Czech commercial person. They had some trade with Switzerland. Anyway, we talked a lot. It was an interesting person to talk to. And so I arrived in Switzerland, and next day I was walking on the main street in Zurich, and I see this guy sitting on one of the, they have these coffee shops where it's all outside. Mm-hmm. Tables. I see this guy, and he waves at me, and he looks, shows me the newspaper. Look, the communists took over in Czechoslovakia.
Oh my.
So I escaped by one day. That was really luck. And this other guy said, what am I going to do? I have a family.
Oh my.
So I never saw him again, but that's so. Then I studied in Switzerland.
What year was this? After the war was finished with Germany, or was during the war?
Long after.
Okay, so this would have been in the 40s. See, you're born in 26. It was 46, 47. Because you would have been, you were out of high school right by then, right?
Well, I had a high school. From Bulgaria. I had a high school diploma, but
then you spent a year in a business school.
So you take a course, and then you're given an exam. Mm. And the exam was, there would be, say, two people and a professor, which is an examiner, and he'll ask questions. But I had started working at that time. I was already, you know, I'd study.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, I hated to study, but I'd grown up.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Switzerland, I wanted to get to, it was a very famous Swiss, it's a kind of engineering thing.
Uh-huh.
And you had to pass an exam. Foreigners had to pass an exam.
And so language were you are using in Switzerland?
German.
German, you're using your German in Switzerland.
Yes, yes. And I knew, because in Bulgaria I had been to a German school, but German and Bulgarian. I had pretty good German, mm-hmm. so that was very important. And then I studied. I had very little money. I studied kind of day and night. It was the most hard work ever. And I made it, because I had to pass an exam.
This is before you actually went to this, got admitted.
They did not, yeah. They don't accept you on, you have to pass an exam. And I managed to pass an exam. Then I had to choose. There was electrical engineering or chemical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I knew nothing much of either. I said, well, might be a bit easier chemical than electrical.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into chemical engineering. And there again, very frugal life and very hard work. I worked very hard. And I got the degree. And I could have stayed in Switzerland, but they weren't too happy. And in any case, I decided I'll have bigger opportunities to get out. And then there was the States, or Canada, or Australia, but pretty soon we gave up on Australia, and I think I'm happy that I didn't go. And I came to Canada, and again I had to look at this encyclopedia, had a map and description of the various places. They had a description of Vancouver. And I liked the sea, and I thought, I'll go to Vancouver, and wrote to the UBC, it was called, University of British Columbia, and sent them my diploma and asked whether they would accept me as a graduate student.
So and you already knew you wanted to do graduate work.
Well, I had finished already in Switzerland.
Your bachelor.
The bachelor.
Right.
So the only thing was then a PhD.
Okay. So you didn't think even think about getting a job and going to work.
Sorry?
So you didn't even think about getting a job and going to work with your chemical engineering?
No, and I'm glad I did. Well, because you see, that's a good question.
I mean, most people, I think, would think about it anyway, but just to...
Well, for one thing, my English was, at that point, still pretty weak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I I just didn't try. I thought, well, I take a doctor's degree. And of course, I'm happy that I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought, and then now, of course, who's going to pay me, I mean, to survive? Well, you could then how was it now? I had to do certain kind of job work. Yeah, supervise. Yeah, their lab, you know, their labs there and their bottles and so on, and their
graduate assistant.
Yeah, this is people that come to take just they're forced to take a chemistry course, and they do a little bit of sort of chemistry, and the bottles have to be full, and you have to watch them, and so. I had, that was sort of the source of my income, but I registered and then I had to choose also a research director, and this then the period of say about 4 years. It's the most frugal life I ever had. In the basement, I had to always rent a basement room, but I couldn't afford to go eat out in a restaurant or anything, so it had to be some facility to cook there. So I go and buy, and again, it's things only cheap food, but I knew how to cook, and I'll cook it there, and so that was a real tough period, but I had to choose with whom to do my PhD, and there was a young prof there, and I went to see what he's doing, and he was in the basement, and he had a mass spectrometer there. His name was Alan Bryce.
A-L-L-E-N?
Yeah, A-L-L-E-N, I think, and Bryce, B-R-Y-C-E.
Okay.
Alan Bryce.
Very good.
And actually, when I looked at the thing the first time, it looked like a monster. I mean, so many things, because it had all radio tubes, and then it's all glass. The tube for the mass spec, that was, you know, special stainless steel. As I mentioned before, that was actually had been built at the National Research Council in Ottawa. So it was, and it had a lot of glass things rather than metal glass. So you had to know how to glass blow if you want to do something. So, fortunately, I became pretty good glass blower, and you can close the door. Just slam it. And what was it now? Nothing was working on it.
So before we get going further with that, I'd like to just ask a couple of questions
back.
So you had a very strong desire to become more educated. Get more education. Was that something that was just your nature, or was that something that reflected your parents' emphasis?
No, at that point I was far away from my parents. They were in Bulgaria still. Yeah. I certainly wanted to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And but I wasn't yet certain. I mean, I would have liked to be in a professor, maybe. Also that work with the mass spectrometer and so, it attracted me to, I mean, I had a kind of a ability, if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And I read, for instance, as I had mentioned before, these were all radio tubes. I mean, then resistors, capacitors, etc. Well, initially I knew nothing of these things, but I got a book and I read about it. There was, because the department did not have an electrical specialist. They had a machine shop. They'd machine some stuff, but no electrical. So I read all that stuff and was interesting and resistant, and then meters you have and attach them. And then the biggest thing was leak hunting.
Mm-hmm.
That had all kinds of leaks, I don't know why. And finally, one day we plugged the last leak, and lo and behold, the thing went down to 10 to the minus 5 tor. And so I could do my work. Now, the funny thing was, I was doing a project. This was again, the prof gave me this project, and a similar work. So it was butene 1, so that's C4. I discovered that already some people have published something, what happens if you, it's called pyrolysis, so you heat it and how does it fall apart.
Mm.
And that was in England by sort of very famous, had already done a study. But I look, what had they studied? They were studying, when you heat it, does the pressure increase or decrease? I mean, due to pyrolysis, suppose that this breaks into two mm-hmm. molecules mm-hmm. from one, the mm-hmm. pressure will increase.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all, they just look at the mercury thing and heat it all. But they had no idea what's really happening.
Right.
And now with the mass spectrometer, and I look, there are about 20 other products. I mean, this is a real super mess. And so I began to enjoy this stuff, and then...
So you were doing a pyrolysis mass spec experiment, basically.
Yes, yeah. Yes, pyrolysis, and detect what the products
are. How were you pyrolyzing? Was just the sample on in a volume that was heated, or was it on a probe, or, you know, I mean... Just pyrolysis like probably doesn't start until you get above 300 Celsius, I would think, right?
Let me think now, because If you took the whole thing, the vape, so to say, there was a whole mess of all kinds of compounds.
Right.
Yeah. So initially, was not very successful, but methane certainly was formed.
Mm-hmm.
So that was butene one. So methane was formed, and a lot of other stuff. And actually, just with the mass spectrometer, you couldn't tell.
Right.
Even if you try to, take the gas and then, you just couldn't do it. And it was funny, there was in the chemistry department, there was a German who had no training. He had been just to high school.
Mm-hmm.
So he was sort of a, I don't know exactly what he was doing, but we became friends. And he told me that there's a method to separate these, and this was discovered by Martin and Singe. I think they were Englishmen.
Oh, yeah.
And it was gas liquid chromatography and gas chromatography.
Mm-hmm.
And
so the German was aware of this?
He told me that it exists. And I went, and again, we had I could do quite a bit of glass blowing myself, but we had, and we then put a gas chromatography thing, and now we could really, it separated.
Mm-hmm.
Propane, propene, this and this, and we saw it's a terrible mess. And the Brits, who had just measured the pressure increase, had totally complete fantasy, and then I got my PhD together. I wrote the thing.
So this was your doctoral dissertation work on the
That's the PhD for the PhD.
Yeah. And do you recall what you were pyrolyzing? Was it a long chain aliphatic?
Butene. So butene one.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is.
It's a gas.
Yes, it's a gas. Just a little higher, it would start getting liquids.
Like
pentane is close to liquid, and hexane already is a liquid.
So then you could put it in a volume and heat the volume up, or did you pass it through a hot tube, you recall, to get the pyrolysis, to get it up to temperature?
I had, it's in a bulb,
like a bomb?
High, that can take high temperature.
Okay.
And a furnace.
Ah, very good.
And you have a thermocouple to measure the temperature.
Ah.
And then all kinds of gases are formed, but also some liquids, so it's a real mess.
Mm-hmm.
But with the chromatography, now the British, they just methane and hydrogen. You put it through the thing, 20 compounds.
Oh, that's very complicated process.
So that was then the GCMS.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful.
Yes. Now, I need to ask a couple of other questions about this mass spectrometer.
Mm.
You say it was built in Ottawa.
Yes.
And shipped to Vancouver.
Yes.
So, do you know any thing about the background of that? It wasn't built by a commercial company.
No. The machine shop off NRC.
The National Research Council.
National Research Council.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where they built it. And
they sent it to me.
Okay, so I guess this Bryce fellow wanted to have a mass spectrometer?
He had gotten one from them.
Okay.
Then when I came here, since I was familiar with this, the chair of the department, at that time, so I tell you, if you just what happened here, because we had a very dynamic chairman.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, when I finished, I got my PhD at UBC, I went as postdoc with Fred Lawson.
Okay.
And he was a wonderful man and a good scientist. He had a mass spectrometer.
And where was he located when you did
that? Ottawa, and it is the National Research Council of Canada, and that still exists, and they did the research there.
So then after you got your degree at Vancouver...
At UBC.
You postdoced at Ottawa.
Yes, and they give you a salary that was... You can survive. I had already gotten married. And I had a very nice time with Fred Lawson. He was a wonderful person. And... then I think I did about 3 years there, something like this, two to three years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had here in Edmonton the university got into a lot of money because of oil discovery just not too far to the airport. Was the first big oil well.
Mm.
So suddenly Alberta gets oil and gets a lot of money. And they don't know what to do with it almost, but they decide, okay, we give the university more money. And the chemistry department here was a sort of sleepy place, and now they have a lot of money. They can attract a Canadian who was in the States. Chairman of some and his name was Gunning, Harry Gunning, and he knew how to spend money.
Mm-hmm.
He anything you wanted, he listened, okay, but there was a lot of money there, you see. And like physics, they were stayed in the dark ages because they didn't have a proper, but this guy was a real, and he said, do you want a mass spec? Yeah, actually he came to NRC, I was with Fred Lossing, he's looking for people, and Fred Lossing must have said, Paul's doing fine, and but he had no time. So they had said, well, So then Fred Lossington, he's in the hotel here, and at he'd have a drink at 7 p.m. That's the best time for you. You go and see him. I've told him. And so that was my wife, Beverly. I said, you'll see. And I go there. And sure enough, so we have a, I forget what I had. At that time, people drank a lot of scotch. So I had a glass of scotch, and Harry Gunnings has a glass of scotch. And he says, I'm offering you this job. So I was very happy.
Yeah.
Just like that. He didn't ask what the hell. And then I came here, and then it was a mass spec of the same type that was made at NRC, but not completely, came here, and we put it up. And that went on. Then gradually we had two mass spectrometers and three mass spectrometers. And
so it sounds like the NRC was building mass specs in Canada to supply to universities.
Not too many.
But I mean, they could, by this time it was 1950.
Something like that, yeah.
And there were commercial instruments available that could be bought.
There were, but they were highly specialized.
Mm.
So they were, safe for analysis of mixtures. And also, you know, it has to be accessible. You want to make a change or so. And we used a lot of for the inlet system or so on. Or, you know, later we had the electrospray thing. Our thing, we could do it. We read about this. We have a glass blower, we have a machine shop guy, and we will do it. Actually, I had this, let me see whether I have these photos of, I think that was him. We were, that was for you, I think, but you had already given me. So these are sort of photos of that instrument and my people at that time. Let me see too. So see, this all the inlet with all the glass and so on.
Oh,
it's all
my
home.
So you were doing.
So that's at that time these were the still that the mass the you know the mass spectrum will come up here.
Strip chart.
Yeah. So, in a sense, we buy stuff for what there. So that's me here. And so, see, they're copper tubes for cooling.
Oh, yeah.
It's a real mess compared with a very well packaged.
Oh, yeah.
But, of course, it's accessible. This is an American guy. This is posed partially, but he said, this shitty damn thing is always giving trouble. Yeah, so it's an American kid. Yeah.
So you got this second instrument from NRC when you came to
Yes.
Alberta.
Yeah.
How did it work? I know it was a different it had some differences, but it worked better when you turned it on than the one at Vancouver, because apparently you spent quite a bit of time getting the Vancouver machine to even work. Whereas here, now, hopefully...
Oh, yes, yes. They and I also I knew much more, in a sense. And I was pretty good glass blower. It's actually quite fun to do, if you can do it. And I would say that I've had a very happy thing, because the young people that came, I would say 95% of them, I got along very well. We managed, we did publishing. We bought a bit later, we bought a triple quad. And that we used also, and I don't know, but led to some 200 papers or so in over the years, something like this. I think that maybe 270 papers before I sort of, well, I was past retirement age, but at some point.
Now, you came from, what were you doing when you were postdocing with Fred Lossing in NRC? Were you doing more paralysis type experiments, or were you doing, and you know, like, and there's a lot of analytical chemistry that can be done.
You know, maybe we can. Do I have the? Yeah, just a second.
List of publications.
I have to have a look here to that I can tell you.
That's okay.
See, at the beginning it's Richard Albright, Lossing, Kibara, ionization potential.
Looks like a lot of ionization potential studies.
Yes.
He had other
I guess, Dr. Hester. I send you the list.
Had other people working in his group as well as you for a variety of research topics. The ionization and rearrangement of acetate esters, electron impact.
Yes, ionization potentials. So, now if you ask me why was it interesting that you do this, I couldn't tell you.
You know that there was this issue with mass spectrometry where a lot of people thought that the analytical capability was hampered by the fact that if you put in a single compound, you got all these other fragmentation pieces.
Yes, yes.
And so there was this kind of an attitude that it was like throwing a bowling ball at a brick wall and eat all these pieces, and there wasn't any rhyme or reason to it.
Well, actually, as for an analysis of, say, a mixture, if you will, the mass spec by itself is, it was the gas chromatography that changed the whole thing. It was hopeless, really. Whoever mixture of butene 1 and butene 2 and pentene, it's a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And however, fortunately, gas chromatography came in, and now they come out one by one. And as the peak comes in, and you've got mass spec, and you look at it. So that was really and that's what it's used now. I mean,
but still, people were upset about the fact that even in a pure compound, you still had all these other peaks, you know, and that fragmentation, the production of those fragment ions.
Yeah, of course.
Their appearance.
Well, if you hit it very hard, it causes. You have to go down. I mean, you could have to see only one. The parent ion, because that requires least energy.
Right.
And so if you hit it very gently, knock off one electron, but don't excite it to break up. Again, that has to be electrons that are easily removed, like if you have a double bond, and so that electron from the double bond is, the electron, are more easily, so it doesn't fall apart. Yeah.
So there was some interest in understanding the fragmentation, the appearance of the ion.
The fragmentation is pretty complicated, I think, to explain each time.
Oh, yes.
For the alkanes, you know, for that don't have. With a double bond, or so, yes, but for instance, this, actually my thesis was with butene 1, so that's sort of CH, a double bond, and then CH2, and then the last is a metal radical. Mm-hmm. And actually, the weakest bond is between the CH3, and because there's some
this
kind of when you pull it off, a pair is. So there is you could kind of predict what major ion will use.
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa, if you know the major ion, you could tell what the compound is.
And so you said you spent probably maybe 3 years with Fred?
I was with Fred 2 years.
2 years, okay.
Yeah. But it was a wonderful time with the guy. He liked to joke all the time. We just once he got mad as hell because we've had to make from time to time some compound. And we had a new postdoc that had come. And he was quite good at synthesis, you know, bottles and things. So he was making a methyl cyanide, and in a fume hood, and but we were having coffee always at a certain time of the day. We get together and sit down. And now, that chemists often do stuff like this. Well, we need sugar, but what I called buy, we go to the chemistry store and they had sucrose. So we get sucrose, and so we had this sucrose, which is sugar, but in a kind of a thing that, you know, they put it in this special. And so now we're having coffee. We had always coffee once a day with Fred and jokes and so on. And now this guy that was working with the cyanide had left it, ended up beside the sugar. And so Fred's taken the thing, but they look very different.
No, oh, yeah.
It's powder, the sugar is sugar. And he takes it in this one. He looks cyanide. He walked out of the room and he just was as mad as hell.
I can imagine.
Of course. Yeah. But I mean, it's also a dumb thing to,
yeah,
to, they could buy sugar cubes and put them in. And so that was really quite something. And that kid actually didn't last long. He left in about a few weeks, a couple of weeks.
Mm. Well, that could be very nasty. Not the kind of mistake that you want to have happen.
No, it's, but chemists do this kind of thing. Always, you can get it from the store.
So you met this Harry Gunning fellow. He was the chairman here.
Yes.
And he more or less offered you a job. Probably, I'm sure that Fred recommended you to him.
Yes, yeah. I had done well with Fred. Yeah.
So he figured out over a drink that you looked like you were okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Say, come along with me. Let's go to Alberta.
Yeah, actually, as I was saying, that I went, he was still in the hotel in Ottawa, and they said, oh, he's at the bar there. And I go to them and I said, are you, and he said, yes. And I said, I'm Paul Kibari. Oh, Paul, have a drink here.
Mm-hmm.
He sat in and he said, Paul, I'm offering you the job. We just spoke maybe 10 minutes,
yeah.
He said. I said, okay.
I wanted to make sure that you were not weird or anything like that. You were a good guy. So, and this would have been then in the early 60s, late?
Something like that, 58,
late 50s.
I think. 58 maybe.
Okay.
Something like that. I'd have to look it up too.
But yeah, if I think, did you send me a CV or...
did I send
a CV of your? I think so. I don't recall.
Yeah.
I thought I did, but those are details that we can find.
Gunning was a real hotshot. I mean, he this department had been asleep, and of course, I think I mentioned before that they had just discovered also the oil wells,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they didn't know, the government didn't know what to do with the money. Well, Gunning knew. So, and then new buildings, and you go and say, I want to have a second mass spec, it's going to cost me so much.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. And so that was a good time. Yeah.
So what did you do with the mass spectrometer here, the first one you got from the NRC? You were starting out on your own now. You're on the faculty. You're an independent researcher. You're starting to get graduate students. What kind of?
I'm just looking here at the papers.
Seems to be a lot of work with mercury in the early 60s. Mercury photosynthesis.
You know that it's amazing, but if you ask me now, what was the...
has a whole series of publications in that one year where you're looking at mercury photosynthesized decomposition. Interesting.
Well, there was also, now we started there was also something with
Alpha particles,
yeah. You know, at that time also, just the first nuclear bombs had been developed, and then the one, it would be say fast electrons or alpha particles, which I guess. So I can't really. I sort of ion molecule reactions in the gas phase, but why we did, you know, who needed that?
The mercury work. Polymerization studies, solvation, hydration. Mm-hmm. All very basic science.
It's basic, yeah. Nothing really.
Alpha radiolysis of methane.
I think in sort of many cases there was something like you have it, and let's say it's an acid, and so you have to take H plus away. Mm-hmm. Maybe you send a base in, and that takes the H plus, mm-hmm. and that happens in the gas phase, and then of course. In solution, the reaction, if say there is water, if this is in water, it would be quite different, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of water. And so we would, in the gas phase, add water molecules to it, and gradually the reaction that we observe begins to resemble that in water. So maybe we've added 6 water molecules or 7, and already it behaves, or whatever the energy required, it becomes similar.
So you're saying you're studying a gas phase reaction, and you add water vapor.
Yes.
And eventually, you add a sufficient amount of water vapor that the reaction proceeds as if it was in solution.
Yes, begins to resemble.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's, and so there hard. Would be, say, it starts happening around maybe 5, 6, 7, they become similar. Initially, they sort of vary. It's quite different.
Because that's a big problem today in the biological business, where people were criticizing a lot of mass spec work in protein analysis and whatnot, is that the proteins don't behave in the gas phase the same way as they do in the liquid phase.
Yeah,
so they're saying that it doesn't work that well. But you're saying eventually there is a point where you can do this work. And
My last PhD student was named is John Klassen. He went into bio, and so he did his mass spec here, but he did that into bio and then we have here another fine, not as young as John, David Bundle. He's in NMR, and the two together do very well. So exactly how they do all this, I don't know now. But basically, of course, NMR is a very powerful technique.
Definitely.
And this John Klassen's work, somehow the two together are doing very well. But
so John's working on the mass spec side?
Yes.
The problem, and the other fellow
is
working on the NMR side.
They've done very well together, and in fact they got some award recently for something. That's my last PhD student. But there was the GC, gas chromatography. GCMS.
That was really hot when it came in.
Yes.
So my analysis shows that you were publishing papers on average, I would say, 6 to 8 papers a year.
Yeah, that was in the good times. Yeah,
from probably the mid-sixties to the around 2000, late 90s.
Yeah, so, but 254 I hear here. The other chapters. So, let's say, Kabarly and Verkirk, electrospray from ions in solution to ions in the gas phase. What we know now. So I would say, by 2010, my work as a scientist disappears.
That's only 3 years ago.
2000. Oh, but then that's not right. That's too. Well, there's a jump from 2006 to 2009, so obviously that's we switched to electrospray. That's very interesting.
Well, didn't everyone?
Yeah. It's ideal.
But, I mean, it was probably, most people were doing it for the biological applications, but you were doing it because it was good for your fundamental studies, right?
Yeah, well, it's...
And of course...
Well, it's analytical method, I mean, it is... because now you can see what's in... You see, gases in the gas phase and so on. Well, I mean, there ain't much of... but when you are now things in solution, well, that's where really all the action is, mm-hmm. is in the solution. So with the electrospray, you can, in a sense, analyze what's in the solution.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of work, it seems, on solvation and hydration.
Yeah, well, I mean, here, prediction of the charged states of folded proteins in electrospray ionization. Well, if you ask me what it is, I can't tell you, but we had a paper there 2004.
Well, that's, charged states are important in proteins,
yeah.
because that helps... and the determination, you know, getting the number of charged states is useful.
Yeah. Yeah, but here is a 250. Ion-ion and ion molecule reactions at the surface of proteins produced by nanospray information on a number of acidic residues and control of the number of ionized acidic basic residues. I don't even understand this, but it's a long title. Yeah, well, electrospray, I mean, this guy got the Nobel Prize for...
Yeah.
Which is actually quite interesting. It's sort of by accident that he got involved with it. He died 5-10 years ago.
I think it was just a couple, not too long ago.
Oh, it's just a couple, yeah.
Yeah. So you really had never, you just decided you were going to go for education and go into academia, and you just went straight ahead. You didn't think about any other career choice.
No.
Okay, so I mean, that's interesting. And you basically, I was wondering if there was any mentors or any teachers that you had in your college career or your high school career that influenced you in any way?
You mean from high school?
Well, anybody that...
See, as I think I mentioned to you, until I was about 17, I was totally uninterested and very lazy.
Oh, okay. You didn't tell me about the lazy part.
Mostly interested in girls and things like this.
Uh-huh.
I began to change at a certain point. And of course, it just begins to show up. And as I told you, when I was in Switzerland, suddenly I could work. You know, now that would kill me to work. I would work, say, 12, 13 hours a day, 14 hours a day, every day, every day, Saturday, Sunday, to make it into the pass the exam.
So this exam that you needed to take, did you have any idea, was there any guidance as to what subjects you needed to be proficient in?
Yeah. They even had one school that you had to pay to go to in Zurich, and it was called Minerva. And they specialized, among other things, in preparing people for the entrance exam, that would let you get into chemical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And but they took 2 years. I didn't have the money or the time, so I said I'm gonna do it in about 4 months. And I worked. I mean, I never worked like that till 12 every night, till 12, starting in the morning from 8 to about 12. Just eat a little bit something and work over like crazy. And then I made it. I mean, it was, well, since then I've never worked that hard, but...
So you went from a real goof-off to a real hard worker.
Yes, you change at a certain point.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I
think that it's not so unusual. I mean, some people do it earlier.
So the Swiss education was basic. Fundamental chemical engineering.
That's good.
But and when you did your PhD work, was that more like in chemistry or chemical engineering, or did did you even have a PhD in chemical engineering at Vancouver?
No, it was chemistry.
Chemistry. So even though you had a degree in chemical engineering, they accepted you as a graduate student for work in chemistry?
Yeah, they considered that just to be, you know, like the first 4 years at the university. And
so were there any students, or I mean, any teachers at Swiss, in their Swiss education that inspired you to in any way, or you were just self-motivated all the way?
No, yeah. They were far removed. They had at the ETH, the British, they had tour, one in chemistry where Nobel Prize winners. Yeah.
Wow.
One guy was Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, and he was a prof giving, but he was as far as a lecturer the worst and also the most demanding. And I remember I had something to hand in, some kind of a, and took me practically a week to get to him. He's Nobel Prize winner. Now he's not interested in the students at all. He's all more research, more things. So actually some of those guys were really, it was very different. But mostly they let you alone. They said, they give you a little piece of paper, and say, prepare this. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Prepare this. You have to go now and study literature. But one, the worst thing that I had happen to me was, the guy said, through pressure, very high pressure, you can make the thing react. And we have this autoclave, and I had to add ammonia, but it was liquid ammonia or so on, I forget exactly. And they also said, we want this in, say, 3 days or... And now, I had in a jewel liquid ammonia.
Mm.
And now, that was a really dumb thing. There was this big autoclave, which is a steel thing. And I thought, oh, I'll pour this and quickly close it. But I pour it and this goes, and all this ammonia goes around. I almost passed out.
Oh, yeah.
That was the, there was a sort of how, actually in chemistry, you can do sometimes things, if you don't think ahead properly, you can really mess things up.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. So, when you did, you were doing, when you got to Vancouver,
yeah,
you were kind of like a graduate assistant, teaching, helping in the labs, and
yes,
that kind of stuff. That helped pay
yes,
your expenses.
100%.
100%.
It's so all in the lab.
And this was also, you had enough money for meals and a place to live?
I it was a very, it was like, of course, at that time, it was something like, I mean, the dollar was higher. I think I had like $100 a month, 80
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had another kind of a interesting thing. The wife of the chairman of the department was also working there. And she was very, always for very discipline and so on. And I was supervising a lab. You know, you have to watch that, because these are kids.
Yeah.
First year, I mean, they're not really going to take chemistry, but they have to take a chemistry course. And then they have to weigh in. And she said, well, you supervise there. And then she tells me, you're not doing well at all. You're just letting them do whatever they want. You have to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
And now that wasn't my nature, but now I'm trying it. And yeah, you give demerits. And then I said, you get two demerits, see, you spilled this. And then suddenly I see all the kids and they say, ooh. And I thought, my God, here, why am I doing that? And this damn woman tries to make me a tough bastard.
Now, then eventually when you got to Alberta,
yes,
you had to teach, didn't you? I mean,
yes.
Yeah. So what was your teaching load like? You know?
Well, that was, you see, the teaching we had, there's first year chemistry, and the classes were very large, could be like 150,
mm-hmm.
200. The vast majority of them was just a requirement. They were not going into chemistry.
Sure.
And they felt they don't need it. And probably they didn't need it. Some needed it. Mm-hmm. Like, we had never any problems with pre-med.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-meds, they knew they have to have high marks to make it. They worked hard. But there were others, like home ec.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a class of home ec, mostly girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm teaching them all this complicated chemistry, and they, first of all, they forget it as soon as possible, and they don't need it. I mean, what is home ec? Is you baking soup or cooking or so?
Yeah.
How the hell are you gonna apply chemistry? I don't know. Put a lemon, acid. So anyway, I went to the home ec people one day, and I said, what can I do that is in your area so that they would be interested? I said, you know, they're totally uninterested. It's a chemistry, but you don't need it to cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, please get there. And so a week passes, nothing. So I went again, and I said, they said, we can't find anything. So they had to admit that, in effect, you shouldn't. But I had problems when there were lots of people in there, like 200 people, and at the back. And they're coming and going during the lecture. They come in, then 20 minutes later, I see them, they're going out.
Mm-hmm.
And some that were really didn't give a shit. They leave even from the first.
Oh, wow.
Not quite the first, but say, they're leaving. And then I said, well, I mean, I have to find out something to keep them. And I then did manage. I started doing some experiments.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what it was. Jello. Yeah, I forget exactly what it is, but I was to show them that gelatin and why does it get so viscous and all this
mm-hmm.
thing. And then I would even, so I prepared I had actually Jello that's already frozen,
mm-hmm.
but I'm showing them, I'm pouring this and then I said, then when it's chilled, you see, it's just Jello.
Mm-hmm.
And I go out to the first row and say, do you want some Jello? They scared even of Jello if you're in the chemistry. It was really funny. The Jello.
And Jello's okay, except if the chemist makes it.
That's it. I mean, they wouldn't touch it.
So you had other classes as well. I mean, to teach besides this was like a.
I liked the physical chemistry. There's a sort of physical chemistry class, and they needed the thing.
And this was a smaller group.
Much smaller.
Yeah,
there were about 20.
Chemistry majors mostly, or physical?
I forget to tell the truth exactly. It wasn't just chemistry, no. But it's second year, and they were also more mature.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed the teaching, and we became friends, and I'd say, you know, I'll. After the lecture, I'll stay and if you have any questions, mm-hmm. please stay with the lecture. Mm-hmm. And then they stayed, that they would come and they talk, and we talk also about other things.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say second and third year, if they needed chemistry, it was very enjoyable,
mm-hmm.
and with a bit of effort, but sort of experiments. Here they don't do much experiments,
mm-hmm.
demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, that was very much the case, that they do sometimes even to excess, like mm-hmm. there's so many things happening that you but this demonstration, you know, making, amusing them, if you want, in a
yeah.
way. But it's chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
And did you feel like the teaching load was not terribly onerous? Or, I mean, was how many hours did you have to...
I didn't mind teaching. I hated it when I see I'm not succeeding.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is, but the teaching part I enjoyed,
mm-hmm.
and also kids, it's also smaller classes. We had a certain point I was teaching sort of advanced physical chemistry, which already had some quantum thing, and you know, you really, if you want to explain it well and so on, you have to put a lot of effort.
Yes.
But I have a class, say, for only five, and I put in enormous amount of effort. But they'd stay there, and they would talk about it and so on. So that was teaching a small group who need it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, so you have to have funding.
Sorry?
You have to have funding, money. You have to have money for your research. So.
Oh, I see. That's now my research.
Yeah, it's not always, I mean, was uh-huh. there, initially it was probably pretty easy to get money, but was it always easier?
We, as I said, that's because of all this oil thing.
Mm-hmm. Did you always go to the same funding in National Research Council? Was the primary research funding operation in Canada?
I think I was getting from them something.
Mm-hmm. Did you get any through the university?
I would say NRC, the university. I would say that mostly also it depended also on the chairman on the so I did not spend much time looking for money.
Hmm.
We just got, I have to think about it, but some money from NRC, where you had to make a proposal.
Mm-hmm.
So we got from NRC some money here from the chemistry department and university. I don't think ever any from private companies.
This was primarily to support graduate student stipends and maybe some purchase of equipment?
See, we weren't using with the mass spec and so on. Once you had it, it didn't cost. We weren't needing a lot of, you know, large amounts. You need just a teensy bit of this and that,
mm-hmm.
and so it was the instruments that you had to have.
Those were primarily funded by NRC.
Sometimes we got them also. They they, like with the, we had a triple quad, and the company sent us one. It had been a prototype, and they had sort of then maybe made some changes and so on. But this prototype, they thought also that it would be some kind of a, if you want, propaganda or so. If we have a triple quad and we start publishing, and then people would, and in fact, the triple quad is a company in Toronto, and one of my PhD students got a job there, and he gradually worked himself up to be a top dog of, on the technical thing. Unfortunately, he had a heart attack and died quite early. I don't know whether he had worked so hard or so, but and so in a sense, with that triple quad, I think we got for nothing. They had it and they didn't know what it was. They had more advanced models and they wouldn't sell this old thing. So we had that triple quad and we used it.
Do you remember the name of this graduate student who was so successful that he
died?
And the company, was that SciEx or...?
SciEx, yeah.
SciEx.
Bill Davidson, I think it was. Bill Davidson.
Well, see, that's a problem today, excuse me, in the purchase or in running a research group, getting grant money is much more difficult, at least in America, than it is... than it was in your time and even earlier in America. And I don't know what, how hard it is to get grant money today in Canada for research. It's very tough. Too much competition for too little money in the States.
Well, of course, you see, the graduate students, of course, they paid some kind of tuition. I mean, it wasn't free. To what extent did this tuition pay for all the expenses is a question. Probably it was a small fraction that in a sense, the tuition. So I think that here probably there was... considerable government support, and like the oil money and things like this. I think that the universities, what I don't know what it is now. I haven't got the fullest idea. We'd have to ask the chair where the money comes from. I think that still probably there's considerable support from the government.
That's good.
That's different from the States, I imagine.
Yeah, well, there is money available, but it's very hard to get in the States. It's very tough competition in the grant game. Now, have you been the recipient? Have you bothered to patent anything for your research?
No, I haven't. Maybe that, to tell you, I forgot. If we have taken a patent, it would be only one. I don't really remember that we. So that was not at all a priority here. It was essentially, if you want, academic. No, that must have could have changed now with the younger people.
Your interactions Now, you've traveled quite a bit, probably going to conferences and so on around the world. You had a lot of good interactions with your peers in different countries and different institutions.
Well, there were conferences and not direct interaction that we mutually cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
But of course we met. You go and give a talk and there's all these are people listening. So in a sense it was always science. Mm-hmm. And not money. Mm-hmm. So we would talk what is happening, and there was mostly it was with the United States. So there was, I would go to conferences. It would be the U.S. Or invited lectures and so on. Mm-hmm. In the U.S.
Do you recall the first ASMS meeting that you went to? Probably. I mean, you were doing mass spec from the beginning, so I wouldn't be too surprised if you went to one of the early conferences.
Yeah.
ASTM, E14.
ASMS, I guess it was. American Society for Mass Spec.
Okay,
ASMS. I went regularly to those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, regularly. It was a friendship there, you see all the... So, of course, from Canada there would be, maybe 5, and from the States there would be maybe 50,
mm-hmm.
something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And, one became... There was a lot of quite... friendships develop, but it's just now I had the name just on my thing and it suddenly popped away.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Beecham was Jack Beecham.
Okay.
So we became close friends with Jack. Jack was a really fine person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like a lot of the work that you were doing would have been interesting to people like Frank Field.
Yes, I was good friends with Frank Field.
And
he was the early Frank Field.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, we were in competition with Frank Field.
That's what I would think.
Yeah.
But I
don't know whether he's still alive. He retired at 65. He wasn't, like, I stayed on. For me, it wasn't any burden. I enjoyed doing it,
mm-hmm.
so I stayed maybe into the 70s. I don't know. But Frank Field had decided he retired. And I don't know what happened to him. He actually was interested in music, and I forget whether it was a cello or so. But we had the guy Fred Lossig, with whom I was in Ottawa at the National Research Council. He had some other instrument, I forget. So they actually used, in the early days, they'd meet and have a quartet. And it was Frank Field. I liked that. We were good friends with Frank Field. At times he was a bit explosive, but on the whole, he...
Well, he had this loud, booming voice that, you know, if Frank said something, you could hear it rooms down the hall.
He was from New York.
Yes.
Yeah, he was from New York. And at some point I was on the board of the American mass spectrometry society, and so I could listen what's going on. I think it was a couple, maybe 3 years before I was on the board, and Frank Field, who was at New York, he said, "I can't understand. We've been here and here and here and here and here and here, but we have never been in New York, and I would insist that." But I think people didn't like to go to New York. I don't know why, actually. It's not such a bad place.
No, I think it's a lot of people perceived it as being expensive.
Yeah.
And
a bit dangerous.
Yeah. Probably it was more dangerous then than now, perhaps. I don't know. But it just seemed like the mass spec people wanted to have a... I mean, they were just as happy being in a quiet, small town as in a big town.
I think we had one. But
yeah, we did have one in New York.
One in New York.
Yeah.
One in New York.
Yeah, I remember going to that conference in New York. Yeah, Frank worked with Joe Franklin. And,
yeah.
Did you know Joe Franklin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know Joe Franklin. Yeah. He died quite early.
Yeah,
Joe,
he did.
I think, I forget, a heart attack or something. Frank Field lasted many, many years after. But initially they were together.
Yeah.
We also had a lot of, in Europe, meetings and so on. This is mostly to have fun, you know, to be at a different place. But,
this, I think, Frank, I think maybe died earlier this year or late last year, Frank.
Oh, it's, see, I didn't know. I'm sort of now totally out of the thing, but we got along well, although initially there was some competition. We had said it goes this way, and Frank Field had said it's gone this way, and I was damn sure that he's wrong. And then they organized to have a meeting. But now I forgot exactly what happened in the meeting. But he finally gave in. He was very stubborn, but he finally gave in this thing. Very good friend. He was very kind of talkative and...
Well, you didn't... If you had a conversation with Frank, you wanted to be on very firm ground discussing science, because he was very knowledgeable and he didn't suffer fools lightly, one of those persons.
Yeah, I don't know how, in a sense, where he, how he switched into mass spectrometry.
I think it was pretty much similar to you, actually. He went to the University of Texas at Austin and was more or less given a box full of parts, and said, the mass spectrometer is yours if you want to do with it. And that's how he got started, which is not unlike your situation, where you see this instrument that at least it's semi-assembled, but it's still, I guess it basically just had so many leaks in it that you could never get it to work. And once you got the leaks fixed, it's amazing. I guess in shipping from Ottawa to Vancouver, the instrument must have developed some leaks, some breakage or whatnot.
Well, also the person that had put it together had, we found out, had some problems at home, and he didn't. He was to finish the whole thing and check it, but he didn't do that. So, for instance, the biggest leak wasn't a leak, but it was there was where you collect the ions, and so there is a current, there would be an electric current since ions are coming on. This is in the vacuum, and so there is a little wire, and it will go to the outside, and so you measure the current that hits there. Well, so this was a little thing which is attached to a stainless steel plate, and there's the little thing where the wire's gone through, and they forgotten to solder this thing, or so it was a wire going through a little tube, but it leaks like hell, of course. They just didn't, because at that time, I mean, they would use solder because you didn't heat that part, and we look for a leak, and it didn't occur to us to go to, and then I think quite by accident, and then finally we discovered there that they've not soldered the damn thing.
So you were using a helium leak detector.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there was all that glassware being shipped from Ottawa to Vancouver.
Yes. Yeah. But in essence, it was a really good training.
Oh, thing. Yeah.
Yeah. As I maybe mentioned before, I just started studying about electronics. And
well, you sort of became an electrical engineer anyway. Well, I think for most people... with instruments in those days, you had to have some skills in electronics in order to keep it running, because otherwise, you were not going to get very much work done. Yeah, I mean, you had to be able to repair, take care of your own problems, no question.
Yeah, so that was the case then, especially with this thing, which was sort of homemade at NRC, and the guy that where we had all this problem is that the guy who had been putting it together and had to do all these things had marital problems, and so
he was overcome
by these marital problems, and he didn't do the work properly. So there
Did you have schematics for, electrical schematics for the instruments, so you knew how it was supposed to be?
We got, we would get like the circuit thing.
The circuit diagram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had the circuit diagrams. And it was, so at that time, you had to know all these things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you weren't doing mass spectrometry, it's a kind of electronics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mechanics, and build is that heavy, or... But that made it more interesting.
So you want to take a lunch break?
I would just... we are talking, so I hadn't even looked at my watch, and just a minute ago, I look and it's 1:45.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I have never had lunch there, but we hope that. So should I take this?
You
wanna